I'd like to thank Molly, too, for inviting me. This is an amazing, fun symposium. I'm going to break from what we've been hearing about so far and give something completely different, which is a very strange part of the genome that's badly understudied, or maybe not, depending on your point of view. But it's these regions of the genome that are super highly repetitive, very simple sequence, highly repetitive runs of DNA sequences that are found in telomeric and centromeric regions of the genome. And I'm going to start by kind of reviewing some things that's already published. We're going to talk about the fact that these satellite repeats are abundant in genomes and also very rapidly turn over from one species to another. In fact, from different populations within a species, we see distinguishing marks. We're going to look at some mutation accumulation studies, two of which were published and one not. Trying to estimate the rates at which those sequences are turning over, expanding and contracting, to see if we can understand, are they consistent with the rates of wholesale gains and loss of these repeats across closely related species. One of those particular experiments did include a sort of a genealogy of the samples, and so we can ask whether the models of a sort of a Poisson process of mutations are fitting, and they're distinctly not, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And finally, we'll talk about function, which is the way to motivate it, and I'll put that at the end. Okay, so the way that these have been analyzed traditionally is to be able to make fish probes, recently anyway, and to then use these fish probes and look at karyotypes and see where exactly are these things hybridizing. And if you look at across different primates, you can identify these different satellites. And in primates, we tend to have somewhat longer ones, 180 base pair sort of repeats. Very easy to make unique probes to those and then to see where they hybridize. And here's a new one that Evan Eichler's group found that's this sort of peritelomeric sort of region. And you can see from chimpanzee to gorilla, it's largely conserved in this particular case, many are highly diverge. We came up with a trick that was an attempt to make use of all the boatloads of Illumina sequence data that are out there, namely to realize that we're not going to make any progress using assembled genomes in looking at these satellite repeats because they simply don't assemble. So instead, go back to the raw reads and ask, do we see signatures of these repeats within raw reads? And so this is just a computational trick, looking for concatemers of, for instance, AA, GAG, AA, GAG, and ask, do we see an abundance of those different concatemers? And so this is a tool that Kevin Way, a former student working with Dan Barbash and me, came up with that is basically just a k-mer approach to it, looking for concatemers of these k-mers. And you end up with a signature much like this one. This is a particular strain of Drosophila melanogaster, and you see a tiny minority of all possible k-mers that could be in runs. We can scan for all tumors up through 20 mers, and we end up with a picture like this, which just shows this huge excess of some of these k-mers over others. We can do this in repeat runs of the same experiment with completely independent biological replication. And it's a highly repeatable sort of process. 1x coverage will give a good signature of these things because they're so abundant in the genome. And if you look across a series of Drosophila species, you see this phenomenon of some sharing across closely related species, but even among closely related species, some wholesale gains and loss of some of those repeats. And if you look at more distant species, there's really very little overlap. I'll just sort of remind you that these are around centromeres. There's other experimental evidence showing they're essential for centromere function, and yet they're cranking along at this phenomenal rate. It's really a fairly striking biological phenomenon. So because we have the phylogeny of the flies, we can put these in a sort of phylogenetic context and decorate the phylogeny with rates of gains and loss of these repeats in terms of copy number. And they're not independent of each other. In fact, from one species to another, we'll see a loss of one and a gain of another, and chances are they'll be related to each other in terms of mutational steps. So you'll see AAGAG mutate to AAGAC and then expand like crazy in another species. So there's this complex dynamical process going on. We looked at this in a collection of lines that we made sort of related to the Drosophila genetic reference panel that Trudy McKay has made that many fly biologists have looked at. We made 84 lines from 5 different geographic locations in humans in Drosophila melanogaster and sequenced them. to only 12x coverage, but this was enough to get very good signatures of these repeats across these lines. And it turns out there's a, in a sense, a phylogenetic signal. We can tell where on the globe the fly came from just from its camer repeats. So at this sort of population level, they're cranking over at a quite good rate. And this picture, right, is that a laser? Yeah, so you can see here that here there are a couple of these somewhat longer repeats that are outright absent in Beijing and Ithaca, but present in the other three populations. So even within a species, we're seeing gains and losses of some of these repeats. And fish probes also show that most of these are mostly pericentromeric. Looking at the viralist group, we've been focusing on these in particular because we have excellent high depth, like 130x PEC biogenomes of the three species, Nova Mexicana, Americana, which are divergently about 500,000 years ago, and the other species, Drosophila viralis, which is about 5 million years from that pair of sisters. And you can see there's a very prominent seven base pair repeat that's pericentromeric in Nova Mexicana, and Americana has it essentially on all of its chromosomes, but you can see it's lost in some of the Nova Mexicana. So just 500,000 years, a rather dramatic rewriting of the Centroameric regions in these two species. If you look at viralis now 5 million years out, there's an outright gain of another seven mer that expands to almost 40% of the genome of Drosophila viralis. So we're putting together a paper that shows viralis is an outlier for people who remember from the 12 Genomes Project. Its genome size is almost double that of other Drosophila, and it's almost entirely due to a seven mer, a single seven mer that's expanded like crazy. It's kind of exciting. There's its sequence, AAATTAC. Okay, so we believe that the mutational process is like that that's going on in microsatellites, namely some kind of replication slippage process. So as this thing gets copied, it's very easy to have long runs of a very similar sequence looping out and causing gains and losses through this kind of process. So let's see if we can understand this whole process a little bit better experimentally. And the ideal experiment is a mutation accumulation experiment. It's going along fast enough, so the typical experiment you can do in a laboratory, 100 generations or so, we ought to be able to see things going on. And this very talented student, Julian Flynn, joined my lab. She had worked at McGill as an undergraduate working on a collection of mutation accumulation lines in this delightful creature, Daphnia pulex. And Daphnia is able, you can grow them asexually, and they grew up a collection of 28 independent lines for 82 generations and sequenced them. The initial question had to do with single base kind of mutations, but because they had a luminous sequence of them all, her first rotation project goes, what the heck, let's look at these satellite repeats. So you can estimate using that K-seq tool the copy numbers of the collection of these repeats that you see in the Daphnia genome. And for each of those k-mers, then you can estimate the increase in variance in copy number across those lines and turn a bunch of cranks and infer the rate of gain and loss of copies per generation. And we put that on a scale of a per copy per generation, just so that the larger sort of runs of repeats are somewhat normalized. And the rates that you end up with are on this order 1 to 4 times 10 to the minus 3 copies per copy per generation. So that's very close to the mutation rate on an order of magnitude of what you see for microsatellites. Only when you scale them up to these full satellite repeats, you're talking millions of copies per genome. So it's thousands of copies change per gamete per generation. It's really a quite phenomenally dynamical process. And the lines at the end of just 82 generations are very distinctly different from each other. Another paper that was published that Julian also jumped on, didn't want to turn this crank too many times, but this was another beautiful experiment because with Chlamydomonas, there were six distinct lines that were then maintained for the multiple generations. And we could see, in fact, there was a significant heterogeneity among the lines in their mutational process. So the starting point matters. So there's a state at which they start and they're mutating away. And again, however, the rate sort of averaged over all these is on that same order, within an order of magnitude, 4.3 times 10 to the minus 4 copies per copy per generation for the rate of turnover in clammy. One other thing that's quite interesting is they don't seem to be gaining and losing copies independent of each other. And so this is just looking at this is the relationship in terms of the the copies and how many mutational steps they are apart from each other. So over time, you get a particular array expanding, then mutations occur, and those mutated copies can now expand and contract. And interestingly, you see these sort of clusters where they tend to have indel differences or single base differences compared to a sort of a mother copy. So it's very interesting to just stare at these figures and sort of try to infer what might be the mutational process that gives rise to that. The point I started to make was this one, which is the correlation structure. So a given repeat in a given line will expand, and if it does, sometimes there'll be another repeat class that also expands, sometimes with no relationship to the sequence. So it's not as though it's just those closely related ones are always co-occurring. They're just somewhat distinct sequences that are in these sort of blocks of correlation. And you look at the different, these are the six different starting lines, and even the correlation structures differ between them. So we're dealing with a complicated process. It's just kind of shuffling the genome in a very strange way. So far, we've talked a lot about mammals. So I did a Google image search for cute mammals, and there you go, giraffes. And another experiment fell into our laps thanks to Kelly Harris, who pointed out that they were doing this analysis of the BXD lines. These are the lines for doing QTL mapping in mice, and Abe Palmer and colleagues have been doing sequencing of a number of these lines. And one of the collections, of course, were the one of the parental lines, which was BLAC6. It turns out there are 14 strains related to BLAC6 that have been in different laboratories. So this is a somewhat inadvertent mutation accumulation line. In fact, we know the history of back in 1921, the original BLAC6 line was the split between these two occurred in 1937 and so forth. There are dates for all these splits that they went into different laboratories, and they're very good records with the mouse inbred strains. How much time do they spend in each line? By the way, they add these suffixes for the different laboratories as soon as a mouse strain has been in a lab for 20 generations. So the BLAC6J is for Jackson Lab. Wherever you see J, that was in Jackson Lab at one point, for instance. Okay, so they have whole genome sequence, 30x Illumina sequence of these. And we can look at the CAMRs with the same kind of tool, just run all the raw reads from those sequencing projects through. And mammals tend, as I mentioned before, to have these longer repeats that are mostly pericentromeric. But there's a fair number of these shorter repeats as well. It's megabase pairs of this stuff in the mammalian genome as well. And you can see that across these 14 strains, you know, there aren't whopping differences. They didn't double or anything in that short of time. It's only, you know, the handful of generations, roughly 4 or 5 per year for mice. So, you know, a few hundred generations across this experiment. And even so, some of them actually did double in abundance of some of these repeats in that short of time. So this is sort of what the phylogeny looks like. We sort of didn't quite get the tree algorithm right, but this is color-coded by the rate of addition or loss of repeats relative to an inferred common ancestral state. And so for this particular repeat, what we're seeing is very low copy numbers here for the BLAC10 strains. BLAC6 and BLAC10 was that original split in 1937, and a fairly high rate up to, you know, it's 1,000 or so copies here. So from 4 to 1,000 copies. That's 4 is not one of these, you know, major satellites, perhaps, but it's almost lost in the BLAC10 strain compared to the common ancestor, whereas it's greatly expanded in BLAC10. This, I would say, has a phylogenetic signature. You can see that the closely related strains have rather similar copy numbers. And we feel good about sort of fitting a Poisson process to that, and we can estimate rates and so forth. However, some of them look like this. Well, this one also was a phylogenetic signal, sorry, but it's flipped. It's just showing that it wasn't the case that BLAC6 was expanding everything in BLAC10, not some of the different repeats are going increasing in one and decreasing in the other, and vice versa. So there are two that have a good phylogenetic signal, and others look like this, where one particular line went screaming along, another one became dead cold, and so forth. And so there's some really odd prior conditions where quite suddenly and quite unexpectedly one line or another can take off, all right? So this is distinctly a non-Poisson process. You know, you can sort of assess the goodness of fit, and it's terrible. On top of all this, there's still a very strong correlation structure. If you gain a particular repeat in one line, you'll very likely gain another one. And so this is just a bunch of these different repeat classes, and how they correlate across those 14 strains now of mice. So there are similarities and differences between the mice and the fly data that I showed you, but there you go. Let's spend the rest of the time talking about function, and there are effects in centromeres, effects in telomeres, they affect chromatin state, and I'm finally going to talk about fertility. So Julian was very proud of this particular image. He's been doing fish imaging of these probes for the various satellites in Drosophila. This is Drosophila virilis with several of those seven MERS that are pericentromeric, and you can see beautifully that they're organized with the centromeres and are involved in that particular process. The idea of looking for effects of these repeats on centromere behavior, of course, is to ask the question, are they involved in organization of the kinetochore? Do they affect the behavior of the separation of the centromeres in meiosis in particular? And this phenomenon of centromere drive is a term that was coined by Harmeet Malik and Steve Hennikoff, referring to this idea that, at least for proteins associated with centromeres, we see a very rapid rate of positive evolution of those, because if there's an advantage for one particular allele, it'll, particularly in female meiosis, it'll get into the egg and result in this drive-like process, a meiotic drive-like process. So we can make crosses between lines with very different K-mer distributions. We can collect embryos, backcross their progeny, and then just do pool sequencing of those progeny and get a picture like this. This was also Kevin Way's work published a couple years ago now, where we're looking at the allele frequency of the SNPs all the way across the genome, and we know close to the centromere, indicated by the vertical line here, if there's a distortion, there'll be some segregation ratio different from that which we expect under Mendel. And very closely linked SNPs will also show that same pattern. So you can see how noisy it is for individual SNPs, but we can smear this out and do a sort of a fit to the recombination map and accurately identify distortions of normal meiosis in these cases. And so we're seeing some of this. So it's undoubtedly the case that some of these repeats associate with particular proteins that are associated then with that phenomenon. Just to mention the mammal data again, this is Mia Levine's work at University of Pennsylvania, who did the work with Harmeet Malik, and is continuing in her own lab with, they started with the CENP, the centromeric heterochromatin, histone, and in addition, HP1 and other heterochromatin-associated proteins also show this positive signature of selection associated probably with a centromere drive. But it turns out telomeric proteins also show this signature of positive selection, probably for similar reasons. Okay, so that's centromere-telomere function kind of quickly. Chromatin state is another one. We know that if you have a big excess of heterochromatin in a part of the genome, like by loading it up with extra Y chromosomes, it can result in alterations in the chromatin state elsewhere in the genome. The idea is the sink hypothesis is that those regions that are highly heterochromatic sort of soak away the heterochromatin binding proteins. The classical way this was looked at was with position effect variegation, and across the DGRP lines now, if you just look at the expression of the white modeled 4 PEV reporter, what you see is this huge variation in the degree of expression of that particular reporter. We can also look at this in Y chromosome replacement lines, and again, you get almost this complete white to complete red opening or closing a chromatin state around the white locus as a result of this transacting effect of other chromatin states. So if the Y chromosome is loaded up with heterochromatin, it acts as a suppressor of position variegation. It opens up the chromatin state of the rest of the genome. And so we in particular did this by doing RNA sequencing of the whole collection of flies that were Y chromosome replaced. And we see many, many different genes that are altered in their expression levels. So these are these Y chromosome replacement lines are genetically identical for the whole genome other than the Y chromosome. Do Y RNA sequencing in those, and you see tenfold changes in expression of genes all over the genome. There's some 612 genes that were differentially expressed, and there's some tendency for them to be near these euchromatin, heterochromatin boundaries. So this is a rather stunning revelation in terms of the effect of the Y chromosome. You should think of the Y chromosome as a grand transacting modifier of expression of the rest of the genome. Any change in heterochromatin state on the Y that has this transacting effect of expression elsewhere in the genome, that Y chromosome will be selected for or against on the basis of that expression change that it can cause. And it might partly explain the severe reduction of effective size well below the 1/4 expected by simple models. Okay, so these things are also transcribed. We notice this in the fact that if we look at the lines that have different heterochromatin states, we can do RNA sequencing in them and ask, do we see the chimer repeats in the transcripts? So for the 7-mer in Drosophila virilis, that 7-mer is abundantly transcribed in female gonads. And so the question is, can we do anything about, and it's also strand-specific, that AAATTCAC is the one that we see. We don't see the other strand in the transcripts. Very suspicious kind of process going on there. So we wanted to manipulate it. So we've designed short hairpin RNAs and are in the process of doing the experiment of knocking down those transcripts to see what they do. However, we were scooped completely by Gary Karpin. An absolutely beautiful paper appeared just 2 weeks ago. Here's the title: RNA transcribed from heterochromatic simple repeats are required for male fertility and histone protein exchange in melanogaster. So in melanogaster, that repeat is AAGAG. They made short hairpins to both identify it by these sort of RNA fish experiments. So in the developing Drosophila embryo, you see it abundantly transcribed. Only the AAGAG, not the CUCUU, the other strand is not transcribed. And it's tissue specific. And if they knock it down with a short hairpin, it's male sterile. So now we have yet another absolutely vital process that's being driven by these simple repeats. We thought they were junk before, but evidently they can have quite severe effects on fitness. So very quickly to conclude, the chimer analysis of sequencing reads lets us get a good quantitative picture of the abundance of these different repeats. We looked at Daphnia chlamydomonas in mouse, and in all three cases we're seeing ballpark estimates on the order of magnitude, similar rates of turnover that are consistent, sufficient to produce these differences between species, but it's highly overdispersed. It does not seem to be a nice Poisson process, which causes all kinds of problems in modeling and thinking about the evolution of them. They show a very strange and strong correlation structure that we absolutely do not understand. And the composition and abundance does impact gene expression and position effect variegation. And that means that these modifiers of these repeats can act as modifiers of the rest of the genome in terms of expression. So they're evidently capable to be under quite strong selection. One consequence of this is there's a phenomenon we call father's curse, where the Y chromosome can drive female deleterious alleles up in frequency. Paper we recently published in Theoretical Population Biology. That only exists theoretically. We haven't gotten direct evidence for it yet, but we're working on that. And some of these chimers display this very strong strand-specific transcription, and those transcripts, at least in some cases, are evidently necessary for male fertility. And so I mentioned most of the people. Didn't mention Yossi is doing CRISPR knockouts of Y genes, working beautifully. Emily Brown now is a physician at NYU, Kevin is a postdoc now at University of California, Berkeley, and Cyril Auer is now at Bucknell University. So we're recruiting too. Anyway, thanks.